What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Eyewitness History Podcast. Today we have the incredible honor of hosting a true icon, a living legend in the world of entertainment. He's not just a singer, actor, and author, but a cultural force who's left an indelible mark on the fabric of American music and beyond. Our guest is none other than Pat Boone. With a career spanning decades, Pat has graced stages, screens, and airwaves with his golden voice and timeless charisma. From chart-topping hits to silver screen successes, he's a multifaceted talent who has stood the test of time. Today, we delve into his illustrious career, exploring the highs, the lows, and the moments that shaped him into the legend we know and love. We discuss his career, fame, and why he said no to making a movie with Marilyn Monroe. Now I give you Pat Boone.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, I'm here with the one and only Pat Boone. Pat, thanks for joining me, sir.
One and only, and a lot of people say, thank God.
Well, my wife even.
She was married to triplets, by the way. She said, I think I'm married to triplets. I wish two of them would go away. I'd like to keep one of them, because I was always so crazy busy.
Yeah, that's funny. I'm so excited to have you, Pat. I want to just, I suppose, wind the clock back. You know, I want to ask you when you discovered you had a talent for music and how you fostered it.
Oh, my. I grew up in a normal family, a church-going family, but my daddy, an architect and eventually had his own construction company. Mom, a registered nurse. These were practical professions, but it was also practical in our lives that we sang together. We went to church together, of course. We even had Bible studies together. And so during those family gatherings, which was a large family between mama's folks and daddy's, that whenever we met, we sang. And my brother, a year younger than me, we worked out some harmonies to sing, Gonna take a sentimental journey, gonna set my mind, daddy's sentimental journey, and I could sing the harmony and him sing the melody or vice versa. And so we enjoyed that, and there were some other songs that we learned to sing. And so I liked that, you know, when my family enjoyed me singing. So now in high school and even in grade school, whenever there's some kind of music and somebody needed that could carry a tune to sing something, I'd hold up my hand or my teacher would know. So right through high school, I became known as Blue Moon Boone. Mm-hmm. Because whenever there was any kind of high school get together, small, large, whatever, and there might be an opening for a guy to sing a song with no accompaniment, I could sing Blue Moon, you saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. And I could sing that with no accompaniment. The girls liked it. The boys didn't mind it. And so I was known as Blue Moon Boone. That led to some radio work around Nashville and eventually a talent contest in Nashville High School. First prize trip to New York and an audition with the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, which was the voice or the America's Got Talent of that time on national television. And I won that contest, which sent me to New York and an audition, no guarantee that I'd be on the show, but an audition. And I got on the show and I won it 3 weeks in a row.
Wow.
Cards and letter voting across. It was not, you know, there's no internet or anything like that. So it was cards and letters. And they told me later they got more votes from Tennessee than any other talent that they ever had on the show from any one single state. I think everybody in Tennessee voted for me because I was a homeboy. I won 3 weeks in a row, and that led to a record contract. And then, you know, to my amazement, I was on it. I was on a career. While I was still in college at North Texas State, I was having hit records and also married to my high school sweetheart at 19. I mean, I was always in a hurry. I was always doing more things in 24 hours than I probably should have been doing, you know, but they were all good things.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Pat. I appreciate it. So I'd love to ask, we were talking about this a little bit before I hit record here, Pat. What was it like having Elvis Presley be your opening act? I believe this was 1955, if I don't miss my mark.
It was 55, March. No, it was October 22. And I already had three hit singles at 21 on the Dot record label. Elvis had one hit. Only it wasn't really a hit. It was a record on Sun Records. But it was a bluegrass song called Blue Moon of Kentucky, Keep on Shining. It was a Bill Monroe bluegrass song, which Elvis tried to make sound like it was R&B, and it didn't work. But he was introduced as a guy who had just been signed to RCA Victor, and he hadn't even recorded yet for them. But Bill Randall, the DJ in Cleveland, the number one DJ in America, had me headline his sock hop on that evening, and he had Elvis flown up from Shreveport, where he was appearing on the Louisiana Hayride, which was the Grand Ole Opry of the South, and making some noise. He was singing country songs, but also he was learning how moving around the stage and whatever he did, and his rhythm and blues inflections, how the kids loved it. So he came up to Chicago, Cleveland, where this sock hop took place on October 22nd, 55. And I was the headliner backstage waiting to go on. And he came in with two of his musician buddies. And did you want to hear about this?
No, by all means, please.
So he walked in. He was very shy. And I said, "Hi, Elvis, I'm Pat Boone. Nice to meet you." And I shook his hand. He didn't shake back. He let me shake his hand. Nobody had taught him yet about how really a man gives a good masculine handshake. He let me shake his hand. And then I said, "Well, Bill Randall, the DJ, thinks you may have some big things waiting for you down the road." I don't know what that, but I hope so. And he just leaned back against the wall. His buddies, that used to know their names, the guitar player and the bass player, Larry, and another guy. They just folded around him. I could tell he was nervous and didn't want to keep talking. And I thought, well, he may have never performed for 650 people in an audience before. He's nervous. But when the Bill Randall introduced him, he went on and he says, "Folks, you don't know this young man, but he's been signed by RCA Victor. Let's give a nice warm welcome to Elvis Presley." So he came on and he lip-synced. That's what they did on a sock hop. You couldn't do it live. You couldn't recreate your record in a sock hop. So you just lip-synced and the guitar synced and whatever. And he did that, "Blue Moon of Kentucky, Keep on Shining." And I could see through the curtain that the kids were alternately saying, "Boy, he's cute, isn't he? But what's that he's singing?" Didn't sound like rock and roll, which was just coming on. And when he finished, they gave him a big hand, though, because they liked the way he looked. He was a good-looking guy. And he wasn't wiggling around the stage. He wasn't doing the hip movements and stuff yet. So he says, "Thank you very much. I hope here's my new, the B-side of that record. I hope you like it." And that was, that's all right, Mama. That's all right with me. Any way you please. And that was rhythm and blues, and they liked that. So did I backstage. Said, oh, I see why RCA wants him. But when he came off, that was it. Thank you very much. And he left. I went on. I got the screens that night because I had three hit singles. And we didn't meet again for a couple of years till we were both renting homes in Bel Air, making movies at 20th Century Fox simultaneously, separate studios, on sets differently, visiting each other. And we got to be good friends. I mean, we were two boys in Tennessee, me from Nashville, him from Memphis, and both happening at the same time. Fortunately for me, I had a six-month head start on Elvis, so that when we met that first night, I said, you seem nervous, Elvis. That, well, I didn't know how to talk to you, man. What do you mean? He said, well, you were a star. A star? I'd only been recording since March. He said, yeah, but you had three hit records, and I didn't know how to talk to you. He was socially always uncomfortable in crowds. On stage, he was king. But off stage and in crowds, his boys were always around him, separating him from signing autographs with screaming girls. He would do that. But small talk with people he didn't know, he was never comfortable.
Fascinating. Thank you, Pat. I really appreciate it. That's a great story. I'd love to talk about some of those hits. As you've pointed out, three hits at that point. I'd love to talk about what the experience is like of having a hit song, particularly when you're young and more or less just starting out, right? I mean, one of them, I think this also was 1955. It was a cover of Fats Domino's Ain't That a Shame, one of your breakthrough hits. Yes, sir. So I suppose after all that bluster, I suppose my question is, how did it feel to record a successful cover, and what impact did it have in your career?
Well, I've often said it can be one of the best or worst things or both to ever happen to you. Because when this happens out of the blue, I was in school at North Texas, and I had given up the idea of being a pop singer because, you know, I won the Ted Mack Amateur Hour and nothing came from it. No contracts. But after I went back to college at North Texas State, married and expecting my first baby, all of a sudden a call comes from Randy Wood Records, a company that was growing quickly outside Nashville. And of course, I was a homeboy from Nashville, and he'd seen all this hoopla about the Ted Mack Amateur Hour. He called me and said, you want to make a record? And I said, well, sure, I'd enjoy it. So he had me come to Chicago. And I sang a cover record, made a cover record of a song called Two Hearts, Two Kisses, which a rhythm and blues hit by the Charms. One heart, not enough, baby. Two hearts will make you feel crazy. One kiss will make you feel so nice. Two kisses take you to paradise. Two hearts, two kisses make one love. Well, that became, believe it or not, a million seller overnight. And the next after that was Ain't That a Shame, Fats Domino, and then a whole succession of cover records of R&B songs like Little Richard's Tutti Frutti and Rip It Up and The Flamingos, I'll Be Home, and on and on. I had, in fact, this is something I'm sure you don't know and hardly anybody does, but a record I hold in the record business is 4.5 years consecutively without ever being off the single record chart. Elvis, after 3.5 years, went to the Army, and he was not recording anymore. That broke his string. The Beatles in the 60s, while I was still going, they went to albums and quit putting out singles. They just put out whole albums. And so I still hold the record of, I think it's 226 consecutive weeks without ever being off the single chart. Always, always there. I lived in the charts. Well, as I say, it can be great for you. It's a heady, heady experience. All of a sudden, boom, your record's being played all over America. And it happened to Elvis pretty quickly after that. And in my case, I was married already, and I was having a baby a year, and I was in college and determined to finish my college education and become a teacher. So when my records took off, I transferred to Columbia University, graduated magna cum laude in in 1958 with honors, all straight A's, but with hit records, movies, and TV shows, all of it happening at once, but with four children, all of this was a ballast and an anchor to keep me rooted and grounded. But for Elvis and for so many other people, most everybody, particularly young people who have hit success overnight, it's so heady and incredible, and you all of a sudden everybody knows you, they want you, you're making money, and you can make decisions that you about your own life that you couldn't have made before. And a lot of times those are not very good decisions. In my case, people knew right from the start, from my first record, when all the TV magazines and the articles appeared, he's married, he's 21, he's 22, he's 23, he's got 1, 2, 3, 4 kids by the time I graduated from college, 4 little girls at 23 with hit records, movies, and all that. Well, yeah, it was all extremely heady and exciting and can really throw your self-image totally out of whack. And it's a ruinous thing to so many young people who have that kind of success overnight. It's hard to handle, and maybe a lot of people take advantage of them and that success. In my case, I was so well-rooted and grounded in church and faith, my family, my responsibility as a father, and I'm still thinking I was going to be a school teacher.
That's incredible. Thank you, Pat. That makes sense to me. You know, we were discussing a little bit before I hit record here, Pat. Someone who's meant a great deal to me over the course of my life has been the late, great Bobby Darin. I know you were friends with him. I know you performed with him. I know you did the Salute to the Teenagers documentary with him. And I'd love to ask you what it was like performing with Bobby Darin, and what was he like as a person to the extent that you remember?
Bobby was, he was in a hurry. I didn't know why, but he knew he had a fatal disease that was going to claim his life early in life, heart disease. And so he was in a hurry. He said he wanted to be a legend by the time he was 30. And of course, he was a finger snapping, if kind of a guy. And he liked that image. That was the image he created. And that was him. He was up on everything. He was intelligent. He could do anything. He was very talented. He could sing ballads. He could sing rock and roll. He could write his own songs like Splish Splash and all the others. But he was in a hurry. And I liked him so much because he had a good sense of humor. He was quick. And when we were doing the TV show, The Cope Special, with Paul Anka, with Kooky Burns, Frankie Avalon, the girls, the ones that did the Avalon movies with the Beach Pictures, Connie Francis, and Annette Funicello. I mean, all these people and cracking some. And Bobby was right on top of everything. He was sharp, funny, and could sing, and everything was perfect. Everything he did had to be perfect.
Wonderful. I need to ask an overly simplistic question, Pat, but to the extent that you haven't already, I'd really love to ask you, what exactly is it like being famous, you know, being a teen idol, being a movie star? I'd love to hear maybe just a little bit about the good, the bad, and the ugly, if you don't mind.
Well, of course, the ugly comes to mind first, because as I say, it can be the worst thing that can happen to you socially, personally. I hate it when all of these talent shows today tell some 13-year-old, you're a star already, or 9-year-old kid who can sing great and they love it, and they make her think she's going to be, you know, a big star overnight, or he, a kid. And then the show ends and there's a whole new set of people competing, and they say the same thing to other young people. And the ones that they were told were going to be stars, you never hear from again.
Mm.
And I think it's not right. It's fine to say you're very talented, you could have a great future, but don't tell some little young kid you're already a major star, because now they're going to look around for the limos and the acclaim and, you know, and the fans, and it's not going to happen for most of them. So when it does happen, though, and you can get used to it, I mean, you think about the young performers who became drug addicts, who made so much money so fast that they married and divorced and married and divorced. They, you know, it can too much too soon. In fact, I said that recently when Lisa Marie passed, and the tragedies that happened in the Presley family, that sometimes too little too long can be worse than too much too soon. That too much too soon, that's the reverse. Too much too soon can be worse than too little too long. People can learn to live with too little and still make a life. But too much too soon can be the ruination. And it has for many, many. I mean, you start rattling off the names of the rock performers that all died of drug addiction and other things and were killed in accidents, car accidents, and even in gun battles. I mean, it's another world to try to cope with, and not many can cope with it successfully. So with me, of course, having a wife I loved and four kids, and all girls, by the way, and I once recorded a song from a Broadway show, when you're the father of boys, you worry. When you're the father of girls, you do more than that, you pray. As a young kid, really, with four daughters to raise in Beverly Hills and in the movie business, I said when Shirley and I moved from New Jersey, where we were living temporarily when the record stuff took off, we moved to California where we could do movies, television, and recording all from the same place. And the girls could have hopefully a steady life in a nice school, which we did. I told Shirley, we're going to live by Tennessee standards, honey. We're not going to live by Hollywood standards. We had a nice home, and we went to church regularly, just like we were in Nashville, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. And we had Bible studies before the girls would go to school, at very nice school with daughters and sons of all kind of performers. And they were mixing and mingling with all of these kids in the entertainment business. But they'd come home from school someday and say, can we pray for so-and-so? Her mom and dad are divorcing and she's all broken up, or so-and-so came home and her mom was in bed with somebody else, or other kinds of problems that the kids from entertainment families were having, even getting into serious problems themselves. And can we pray for so-and-so? Can we pray for her, him? And we would have a prayer session for their friends. So as I say, we decided to live by Tennessee standards, though they grew up in Hollywood. And that was a big star, going to the premieres and all the parties and making movies and hit records and TV. But we were living so much so that I didn't have many close friends in the entertainment business. Most of my close friends were folks from church and from school and just people that we knew that weren't even in, that they were relatives or they weren't in the record or the entertainment business.
Extraordinary. Thank you, Pat. That's very interesting. That makes sense to me. Well, getting back to performing, the question I've really been wanting to ask you, which I'm just incredibly curious about, is if you've ever been nervous before a performance, how you manage your, let's say, emotional state or nerves before you're about to go out and perform.
Well, somebody said once that stage fright is a sign of intelligence. If you aren't frightened and nervous when you know a big event is happening. I mean, I sang twice for the Queen of England.
Yeah.
I did two command performances with my voice up here in my throat. I was trying to make sure I could try to keep my nerves out of my throat. I'm singing for the Queen of England and the royal family and the Palladium twice. And then for presidents and for major audiences, of course. But even before that, when I was just a teenager singing in talent shows, I was always nervous, and who wouldn't be? And you learn to cope with it. And when I was doing local television in Nashville, those two little red lights, when they came on, I knew was thousands and thousands of people looking at me. But I just tried to think that I was singing for one person, and I'm trying to just be as normal and natural as I possibly can. So when I went to network television, I'd had a lot of experience locally in Nashville and in Fort Worth on WBAP Channel 5 doing a country music show called Beulah Barn Dance, sponsored by Beulah Mill Flour, on Saturday night. And then a teenage show on Saturday afternoons called Foremost Teen Times, featuring teenage talent from three or four states around Fort Worth. And having that kind of experience enabled me, when I went on national television and in front of presidents and some of the top people in the entertainment business, to cope with, I just kept saying, this is just like I'm in Nashville. It's the same thing. I'm just the same guy, and I know I can sing, and I'm going to sing my songs, and I'm going to have fun doing it. And those little red lights are just two little red lights. We want millions of people, as I knew they were.
Right, right. Thank you, Pat. I'm always curious about how people make career transitions. In your case, moving, from music, of course, to film, Bobby Darin, as you undoubtedly know, got an Oscar nom for his work in Captain Newman, M.D., when that came out. Yeah, so I'd love to ask you what it was like when you decided to make the career transition to film and what that was like for you.
Well, it just happened. It just flat happened, like most of the things in my career. I tell young people when they ask me, how can I be successful like you did? Well, I can only give you what I did. I made God my agent. What do you mean? God, I said, an agent is one who opens a door for you, creates an opportunity for you. If you go through that door, he tries to help you make the most of it, do a good job. If you do and you get more opportunities, he tries to help you make the most of those opportunities. And by the way, any good agent's going to get 10% at least. And I said, I made God my agent. I prayed about everything I did. And doors opened that I hadn't sought, didn't even know about. When Randy Wood called me from Dot in Gallatin, I was already preaching in a little country church in the wheat field in Slidell, Texas, outside Denton, way outside Denton, 30 miles. And I go back to be to make a record, but I didn't seek that. It sought me. I'd won talent shows, but nothing seemed to have come from it. But then the records started happening, and then the movies, and the television. I had about three or four hit records, and all of a sudden, I was the youngest guy ever to have his own network television show on ABC, the Pat Boone Chevy showroom. And I didn't seek that. The Chevrolet, well, the first people who came to me when I was offered my first television show, when I'd had about five or six hit records, was a Schlitz beer. They wanted to sponsor me on TV for teenagers. I mean, well, obviously my audience would be teenagers, but I turned that down. I said, I don't drink. And they said, well, you don't have to, just do your songs. But I turned it down. And then the next time I was offered a show, the sponsor was the Chesterfield cigarettes. I don't smoke. Well, you don't have to smoke. Perry Como doesn't smoke much, but he sings for cigarette company. Wouldn't do it. Well, finally, the third time came from the agents to my manager, said, you got anything against Chevrolet? I said, no, I'm driving a Chevrolet right now. So Chevrolet became my sponsor, but I didn't seek it. It came to me. And then ABC Television presented me with the possibility of being the youngest guy ever to have his own network television show, and all the big stars in music coming and appearing on my show with me. And then movies, the 20th Century Fox offered me the movie contract. First, a screen test. I had to fly out to Hollywood and do a screen test and just try to be myself. A young Bing Crosby is the way I was seeing myself as a young Bing. Try to be very natural and just kind of hip and loose and natural. And they liked what they saw. So then I signed a 7-year movie deal. So all of these things happened to me. And I try to tell the kids that just keep doing what you can do, whether it's singing, dancing, playing an instrument, in any honorable chance you get. Don't sell your soul for it. If somebody comes along, some wise guy, and offers you money or whatever, if you'll do this or that or the other thing, that's immoral. Resist it. Don't ever sell yourself. If God's in it, and if you're praying about it, making him your agent, he can bring you offers that you never thought of. It's what he did for me. But he may have a better idea for you than being a trumpet player for a career or a tap dancer or a singer. He may have a better idea for you.
Any honorable chance? I really like that. I had an experience recently where I had to do something similar, turn away something that was a good opportunity for the right person.
Yeah.
And it wasn't something that aligned with me and what I wanted to do. So I can meet you there. Will you allow me a smooth transition, Pat? Yes, the Pat Boone Chevy Showroom aired for 115 episodes. I believe was aired between 1957 and 1960. Yes, sir. And as you mentioned, you had a number of great stars coming on during that time. I'd love to ask if there are any specific memorable moments that stick out for you that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Well, of course. I mean, gosh, I sang, not Sentimental Me, but, Connie Francis' big hit record with her. And I would sing some of the major stars come on, like Paul Anka and Frankie Avalon and all of them on with him, Bobby Darin, and also Perry Como, and also Nat King Cole and Ella Fitzgerald. And they're all come, Tony Bennett, all singing with me, Mel Torme, their songs, and then my songs, and we sang together. And it all went off almost without incident, except once, twice, and take a two, once. I was going to sing an Irving Berlin song, and he wrote so many great songs, as you know, with White Christmas and on and on and on. And so we thought we were going to open the show with a song which we had been told was one of his own favorite songs, Lazy, a song called Lazy. So we had somebody call his secretary. Will you please tell Mr. Berlin that Pat Boone's going to sing a song that he's heard is one of Mr. Berlin's favorite songs, Lazy. And they said, well, what time is it on? He likes Mr. Boone singing, but what? It says 9 o'clock. Oh, well, he may not be watching television at 9 o'clock. but perhaps if he knows Mr. Boone is going to sing that song, but we'll let him know. So I assumed Irving Berlin was watching. Now, we had set the stage very elegantly, for a half hour music variety show on ABC Thursday nights. And we had a set made up to look like a riverbank, and me and the singers are in overalls, and like we're having a picnic outdoors, and I got a piece of straw in my mouth, and I'm going to lean back and sing Lazy, I want to be lazy, and it's live. So now, in those days, I would know the melody, but I didn't always know all the words because we had teleprompter.
Mm.
New thing, but we had teleprompter, so I could read the words off the teleprompter if I couldn't remember them, because I knew the melody of the song and the arrangement. So now we're just about to go on the air, and the camera's right here on my face, and we're on this riverbank, and I got the straw, piece of straw in my mouth and a straw hat. And the cameraman comes up and starts shaking the camera. What's the matter? He says, teleprompter's stuck. Stuck. I need it. Come on, get it. All of a sudden, the red lights come on. I'm live, and I've got to sing a song that I'm not fully aware of. Lazy, I want to be lazy. I want to lie back on the grass. And you try to think of a word that rhymes with grass. And I don't know what I sang that night. I was remembering some of the words, but not a lot of them were just made up on the spot. And sometimes what the singers were singing would tell me what I was supposed to be singing. But I made a total botch of it. And it was live. It went on the air. I never heard from Irving Berlin. He never called, and I'm hoping he never saw it. but he did. After that, he wrote the backliner, very favorable, on an album of his music. I did the Irving Berlin songs, all Irving Berlin, in the late 50s. No other pop singer was doing that. Everybody else was trying to do rock and roll, and so was I. But I did an album of big band swing. I did an album of hymns. I did an album of all Irving Berlin ballads. And he wrote the back liner notes. It looks like his hand on the back. I don't think it was his hand. But then it showed what he wrote. Very complimentary. I like the way Mr. Boone sings my songs. So I have a feeling that he did that before I did Lazy. Didn't like the way I did Lazy. But there were many things like that that could happen live television, and you just had to ad-lib and keep going. Dick Clark, on his blooper show, one show at a time, when my show began, and the mic was not working. And I'm on singing, and the background singers and the band's playing, and I'm singing. And while they're trying to get another mic, a boom mic swung over to me, it knocked the set down behind me. I mean, the whole show became a shambles right there in the opening tune. And we went away to a commercial. When we came back out, they had the microphone overhead, but I couldn't resist. So the red lights come back, and I do this, act like I couldn't be heard, and the sound man was, no. But and then I laughed and started talking and just told the audience what had happened. And, you know, these things happen when it's live TV. Well, see, I'd had enough experience in Nashville and in WBAP in Fort Worth that even though I was 22 years old when this was happening to me live on national TV, I could just go roll with the punches and going.
Some incredible stories there. Thank you, Pat. That's hilarious. I know you've spoken out on issues like censorship, for instance. I'd love to ask you how your conservative values shape your social stances.
Yeah. Well, they shape me. They are unshaken, I should say. I'm still the guy from Tennessee, and I still believe all the same things I believed, and I live by the same principles, of course. So I grew up conservative politically. My parents were, except Mama was more of a Democrat. Daddy was more of the Republican. I say more of the Democrat in that she took in every stray, dogs or people. And we had as many as 17 cats at one time. And Mama just wanted to feed whoever needed to be fed. Daddy is a construction company, still not solidly on its feet. And he had four kids to take care of himself. You say, Margaret said, if we keep giving away so much, I'm going to have to be asking for help myself to pay my own taxes. You know, he was a conservative Republican who knew you had to stick to the budget. Mm-hmm. Mama, Democrat, who says, come one, come all, and we'll figure out a way to handle it. And so I grew up that way. And so I grew up with biblical principles, and I applied all those principles to roles that I did or didn't do, songs I did or didn't sing, books that I was asked to write. But I did write a book called Twixt 12 and 20, mm-hmm, for teenagers. And the publisher, it was a secular publisher, Apprentice Hall, and wanted me to do a book of moral good advice for kids. So I wanted to do that. I was still in college at Columbia, and here I'm wanting to be a teacher, but I'm going to write this book. So I wrote a book on biblical, practical, moral principles for kids, and I called it Twixt 12 and 20. The publisher didn't like that title. What's it mean? I said, well, think a minute. What's between 12 and 20? Oh, teens. Yeah. And I liked the alliteration. I was an English major. I thought I was going to be a teacher. The book came out, and it was a million seller. It sold many millions in this country. Twixt 12 and 20. It was number one nonfiction bestseller. Were number two, either way, but one or two for 2 years, only challenged by Art Linkletter's Kids Say the Darndest Things, Norman Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking, or Twixt 12 and 20 by Pat Boone. Went into other languages, went around the world, and here I was in college. Still, I'm not out of college, and I'm teaching through my book, and then through the first million-selling hymn album that was ever made. While I was in college, it was all the church songs that I sang in church, but I knew that the millions of teenage fans of mine, many of them didn't go to church, didn't know any of those songs. I knew they would buy anything I recorded. So I made an album called Hymns We Love, and it was a million seller, the first ever million selling hymn album. While I'm doing also rock, bop, bop, a loo, bop, 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 tutti frutti, I'm singing Tutti Frutti, Ain't That a Shame, also hymns, also gospel songs.
Mm-hmm.
and writing books for kids. And I graduate from college at age 23 with four kids, and we're getting ready to move to California. We stop in Villanova, Pennsylvania, that got all the royalties from that book, Twixt 12 and 20, was a startup Christian college called Northeastern Institute for Christian Education, acronym NICE, a word I was trying to escape because Elvis was, you know, that swinging young kid, bachelor, and Pat Boone, the parents said, why don't you like that NICE Pat Boone? You know, because he's married and has kids and he's, you know, he's a church-going guy and whatever. Well, I was, but that wasn't as exciting to some of the kids as the wild living and wild singing, hip swinging Elvis.
Right.
So now NICE was the acronym for the college. It got the million and a half dollars from royalties from my book, Twixt 12 and 20. And I go there. We stopped at Villanova, Pennsylvania to see the college that was now being built and created from my book royalties. And on the administration building, which had been the estate house of the family that gave it to the Christian people to have the college there on that campus, on chiseled in stone was Boone Hall. So here I'm out, just graduating from college, and there's a college with my name on it already. Book from, so now, because of all of this, Josh, I mean, I'm telling you this just because these were the things that kept my feet on the ground. These were the things that helped me make decisions that I'm still making now. In today's world, the decisions I make, the votes I make, the people I vote for, the measures I'm so upset about, the anti-Semitism sweeping the country. It's like Nazi Germany again in America. Has been. Fortunately, I think we're going to get that straightened out. But I just saw today on the news, over 20% of Americans who were interviewed don't believe that the Hitler Germany thing, the Holocaust, happened. They don't think it even happened. This the education system. And here I was going to be a teacher.
Yeah.
And I was a Christian principal in class, secular. But now these college presidents are actually not only endorsing, they have been, but the schools are teaching courses that the kids don't know any better, and they grow up believing falsehoods, things that aren't even true. You know, that America was a slave nation. America was not a slave nation. Yes, there was slavery here. There was slavery all over the world.
Yeah.
Part of international scene when Thomas Jefferson, who I just played in a movie recently, it's not out yet, but I played him, and he was the one that managed the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of America at that time. But he owned slaves, and Sally Hemings was one of his slaves that he married and with whom had six kids. So slavery itself was in some ways different. In that, not that it was admirable, it was not, but it was established already, and people were growing up on states and in states where it was just a fact of life, and it needed to be abolished. And come along Lincoln, by the way, whose voice I just did in another production, so I'm sticking to these Christian principles that I grew up with, but Lincoln abolished slavery. But even Jefferson, when he was president and owning slaves, said, this is wrong. This should be abolished. He and some of the other slave-owning creators of the Constitution knew it was wrong. Eventually, it was going to be done away with, and was. But we were not built. We were built by farmers who threw down their axes and their hoes and picked up muskets when we had to fight the British and the French. And they went to battle, and with God, seeking God and his principles, which was all in the Constitution, we hold these. And it was Jefferson who said in the Declaration, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. There's a guy who owned slaves, but he said, we know they're all created equal, and was saying for the public to know that this institution of slavery has to go. Mm-hmm. While it was there, they were still part of it. So we need to go back to the Constitution. These men created a Constitution built on biblical principles, and things that were wrong in the Bible are wrong now, because God created both. He created the Bible. He created Israel and called them his chosen people. And I'll bring you back after they were absolutely wiped out for their disobedience. He said, I'll bring you back. And when you are established in Israel again, this will forever be your land. It was not given to, quote, Palestinians. There was a whole other area, vast area, in which those called Palestinians were the Philistines. The Palestinians still today own 100 times and 1,000 times more area than this little place where the Jews gave Palestinians Gaza to establish peace. But once they got Gaza established, it became a launch pad for missiles coming into Israel. And if you fight Israel, you're fighting God. And I don't think you want to be on that side if you get your mind straightened out with real facts, historical facts, then you know that Israel belonged to the Jews way or 3,000 years ago. He told Abraham, the father of Judaism, and then Isaac and Jacob and the 12 tribes. Esau also had 12 tribes, and his 12 tribes were in what is now known as Assyria and would always be in enmity with his brothers. The descendants of Jacob with his 12 tribes. So that's history.
Yeah.
And we're on the wrong side of history and on the wrong side of God if we want to deny Israel, the people God says, the land, he says, are my chosen people, and this is where I'm making my home forever. I mean, we've got to get our minds square with hard facts, historical facts, biblical facts. To depart from those is to seek the same fate that all the other nations who have abandoned God and Bible principles have suffered, and many of them are suffering now.
I couldn't agree more, Pat, with any of it. So thank you for saying it. I appreciate it.
Could I just interject one thought?
Yes, sir. Certainly.
How long we have, but I, in that theme, along that line, my latest book, and I've written other books, of course, but this latest book is called If, the one word If. And I've discovered it's the most important word in the Bible. Mm. It is there more than any other word except and thee and T-O, too, those words. But it's the first word in Genesis. If Adam and Eve, if you eat this fruit, the knowledge of good and evil, you'll die. They did. They died. In Noah's time, he found that all the thoughts in man's heart, since they were given free will, eventually human nature will lead them away from God. And he repented. He was sorry that he made man in Noah's day. So he wiped out all but 8 people, Noah and the ark. And 8 people survived. And through Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the other tribes of the world grew, and he tried again. He was always trying to create a family of kids who would want to be like their daddy. That's all. He already had one son, Jesus, and he wanted a whole family of people, human beings, created in his image. Well, throughout the whole Bible, 2 Chronicles 7:14, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, turn from their wicked ways, I will hear from heaven and forgive their sin and heal their land. That's the if. Well, we like to quote it, say, well, hey, we're like that. We name him. We seek his favor. Have you turned from your wicked ways? Well, forget but. All as important as if.
Yes.
In John 3:16, God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever should believe in him should not perish, but have everlasting. What? What was that? Shall not perish? It's the if in John 3:16. On the way to the book of Revelation, the 7 churches that are written to by John on the Isle of Patmos, if you don't straighten up, you churches in the first century, then that awful time will come when Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, many will say to me in that day, didn't we do mighty things in your name? Didn't we cast out demons? And weren't we all good disciples? And he'll say, depart from me, I never knew you. Because even though they did good things, that's not what gets you to heaven. It's seeking God and his will, whether you call yourself Christian or Hindu or Muslim, whatever. Seek God and do his will, and then he will take you into his eternal family. But just being involved in an institution or a church or is good. It may accomplish good things in this life or may prompt a lot of bad things. But the important thing is to get on God's side of everything. And it's all simple. It's written there. It's the most popular, more books, Bible sold still every year than any other book in the world. And yet we put it aside and don't pay any attention and we scoff at it. So I just want you to know that the book I wrote, if I say on the cover, it's not religious, it's just life or death, and that our eternal destiny depends on those ifs. If God, if you made God your agent or Jesus your savior, if those things pertain and if it's true and it's real in your life, then you can rest easy no matter what happens to the world. It won't be enjoyable, but at least your future, your eternal future is secure. But if you pass up the other side of the if, the fate is already established and it's not going to be good. Though I hate to say that because it sounds so harsh, but I'm just saying what the Bible says, what Jesus said, and I don't want to be among the ones who say, well, didn't I do a lot of nice, good things in my life? Depart from me. I never knew you. You and I never were intimately involved. We were never, you were doing some good things. That's nice. But we weren't hooked up together. You didn't belong to me.
Yeah.
You didn't make me your savior. Anyway, those are some of the things that I still adhere to. Nothing's changed in my life. Conservatively, I still think we were built on biblical principles and we need to once again commit ourselves to biblical and constitutional principles.
I couldn't agree more, Pat. Thank you. I appreciate you running through all that. I am keeping an eye on our time, sir. I don't want to abuse your time any more than I already have. I know we have just a few minutes left. I would not forgive myself if I didn't ask you about turning down a film with Marilyn Monroe. please tell our listeners a bit about that. What informed that decision? What that whole scenario was like?
Well, I wish I could say I had met Marilyn and I could have explained it to her, but even she was under contract at 20th Century Fox at the same time I was. And come to think, we weren't that far different in age either. But anyway, she'd already made some successful films, and I had made some successful films aimed at largely a different audience, more of a teen, young audience than some of Marilyn's films. But Buddy Adler, the head of the studio, had this wild idea that we do a movie, Marilyn Monroe and I together, and it was a William Inge play. Big script, be successful, high budget. And when I read the script, of course, I was excited about the possibility of making a movie of Marilyn Monroe. But when I read the script, it was so immoral. It was about a young kid having an illicit affair with a almost, well, not over the hill, but still beautiful, but older woman who was a cabaret singer. Actually, William Inge wrote a play about that, and then he wrote another one very much like it, and I forget what this one was called, but I do know that eventually it was made by Joanne Woodward and Richard Beamer, and it was a terrible flop. It went nowhere. However, that same script, probably with me and Marilyn, as Buddy Adler, the head of the studio, thought, would have become a sensational, very controversial hit. But I couldn't do it. I said, Mr. Adler, I've got millions of fans, and this movie, I'm playing a guy that has an affair with Marilyn Monroe. What young teenage boy wouldn't like to have that happen in his life? And he said, but you're an actor. You're just playing a part. I said, yeah, but I am, whether I want to be or not, I'm a role model. And the roles I play are in themselves can be role models for kids that are influenced. I can't do it. Well, he was furious, but he said, you know, we could suspend you because you're holding up production. We wanted you to make this film. Well, we'll make it with somebody else. Then he put me into a film called Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Yes.
Which became a huge, huge cult classic hit. And I was told recently that an executive at 20th at that time said, you know, that film saved our studio.
Wow.
What do you mean? Well, Cleopatra was about to send 20th Century Fox into bankruptcy. That's why Buddy Adler was so anxious to get a heavy hitter box office success. He thought me and Marilyn Monroe might be it. But I turned it down. So they made that movie with Joanne Woodward and with Richard Beamer, but had me make Journey to the Center of the Earth, which was a science fiction, huge hit. And when it came out, the banks were getting ready to foreclose on 20th Century Fox, shut them down because they were so far over budget with Cleopatra, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton going off to Spain for a week, leaving 500 extras in costume waiting, standing around, wondering what do they shoot next?
Wow.
And the banks were fed up, and they were going to shut 20th down until suddenly Journey to the Center of the Earth came out and saved the studio. But if I had done that film, it would have been bad for me. It would have been bad for 20th. But again, I just stood to my own guns, my own principles, and it turned out well, not just for me, but for 20th.
That's incredible. It's amazing where life can take you when you least expect it. My very last question, Pat, I promise. What would you consider to be the most defining or pivotal moment in your career?
Well, that's a big question. Defining a pivotal moment. I could pick some of those movies. There was another Bing Crosby-type film that would have been another huge hit and good for my career, you would think. But I felt, ran counter to some of my religious principles, so I turned it down. And again, I made another movie which was a big hit in place of it. But so those are very important decisions. I think the most important moment was marrying a girl named Shirley Foley, who was the daughter of Red Foley, who was eventually the Country Music Hall of Fame guy who had many, many hit records, pop and country, and who also did so many gospel albums. And she was a Christian girl and I was a Christian guy. And when we married at 19, because her mom had died and her father was taking the girls, including Shirley, to Springfield to start the Ozark Jubilee, which nobody knew would be a huge hit, but it was. But he was taking the girl I loved and wanted to marry away. So at 19, we asked his permission. He tearfully gave it because he'd married her mom when she was 17. So Shirley's mom was born when her mom was 18. Shirley was born when her mom was 18. So now Shirley was 19. So Red gave us his permission, but he asked me, are you going to take care of my girl? And naive me, I said, yes, Mr. Red, I'm going to take care of her. And his tears ran down his nose into his coffee, and he said, I'll buy your rings. And he did, and he said, when do you have in mind? We said, tomorrow. I thought it was going to be Saturday when he left with his family. So that marrying her and committing our lives to God together, our family, our marriage, career, whatever it might be, I thought it was going to be teaching. But those commitments to God helped us keep our marriage together during all of that time. The entertainment career could have taken us apart. Four kids. She went through some serious physical problems. Four teenage daughters, all married. Not one of my daughters ever had her own apartment. When they got into their early 20s, they still lived at home. Debbie, when she had You Light Up My Life, huge record, was still living at home. She eventually first opened for me for a while. It was Daddy Daughter. But then she opened for Kenny Rogers and Glenn Campbell and many other performers. But she'd come home and they had their own cars, but they lived at home until I drove them to their weddings and then said goodbye to them and their husbands as they drove away from the weddings. but that has to be the most important principle other than my own commitment to Jesus when I was 13, which made me know that I was a child of God. I was a son of God, but now I married a daughter of God, and we made our commitments to Him. Now that carried me through all that entertainment stuff into a career that now has embodied many, many things. We've started whole Christian charities that began in our home. I helped start the ABA and basketball. I'm the only entertainer involved in the foundation of the ABA. And I owned the Oakland Oaks, which won the championship with Rick Barry in our second year. Of course, it nearly bankrupted me again when the whole ABA went bankrupt. but I survived even that. So I've been through many, many serious problems and threats in my life, financially and otherwise, and temptations of all types. But my rock-solid commitment to the Lord and to this wonderful woman who died several years ago now, she didn't die, her body did. And she used to sit in this very chair where I'm sitting now. And when she passed away, we knew it was happening. And the four daughters and I were standing around her as she was not conscious. And the nurses said, "She's slipping, slipping." And we were singing, "Blessed Assurance, Jesus is mine. Oh, what a foretaste of glory divine. This is my story. This is my song. Praising my Savior all the day long." And we held that note out to see if she would take another breath, and she didn't. And tearfully we sang Blessed Assurance, and we sang her into heaven. Now, the Associated Press asked me for, you know, my comment, and I said, "Shirley Boone is change of address. She's not living in Beverly Hills now with me right now. She's living in a mansion in heaven, prepared for her and for me. She's waiting for me to join her in that place where the one who built the mansion says, 'Where I am, you may live also. You may be also.'" So just a change of address. People say, "Oh, we're sorry you lost your..." I didn't lose Shirley. I know where she is.
You'll see her again.
I know we're going to be together, and it probably won't be long. So I'm glad to tell you this now. Maybe a lot of people will listen. "Oh, well, it finally happened. Pat's back with Shirley again."
Indeed.
All through my entertainment career, the decisions I made were based on those, don't make me cry, those two decisions I made early in my career, before the career even happened.
Beautiful, Pat. Thank you. Almost made me cry. Well, I have to say, Pat Boone, it was such a pleasure to speak with you, sir. I know you obviously didn't have to do this if you didn't want to. And
I love talking about it. It takes me back and reminds me of how I got here. And if it'll help anybody else, that's the important thing. I know you have a large audience, so and maybe people think conservatively like I do, hopefully. If they're not sure what to think, go back to the one who makes all the rules. Everything there is. If this watch doesn't function properly, I'm going to send it back to the one who made the watch and let him fix it for me. So if this country gets out of whack continually as it is right now, we better send it back to the one who created this country and get back to the rules that created it. And so I take advantage of every opportunity I can to share with others, hopefully, what I know and believe. I don't think less of anybody if they don't believe in what I believe. Don't put them down, but I sure am anxious to share it with them in the hope that we can all come to an agreement that the Creator of all things probably knows how it works best. And that includes us.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah. Pat Boone, this was such an honor to speak with you, sir. Thank you so much again. I really appreciate it.
Well, I enjoyed it too. And Josh, you know, is it Joshua?
Josh.
I know, but is it Joshua too?
Oh,
I
mean, yes, it is.
No, I should tell you this.
Yeah.
Recently, and people don't know this either, most Jews don't know it yet, but I'm trying my best to make sure they do know it, that the oldest rabbi in Israel, Itzhak Kaduri, 105 years old, came out of his study on the Day of Atonement to tell his disciples, rabbinical students, "The Messiah has appeared to me, told me his name. I know his name. I've written it on this piece of paper. I'm sealing it. Don't want it opened till a year after my passing." And he sealed it. And I learned of this in a book called The Rabbi Who Found Messiah while he was still living, Kaduri. But shortly after he passed, my friend Netanyahu, the prime minister, was in with him in his office, just he and I. And I said, "Your rabbi has revealed the name of your Messiah, and it's in handwriting, and it's now on his website for you to read in the book, The Rabbi Who Found Messiah. And he revealed the name of your Messiah." And Netanyahu said, "Which is?" I said, "Yehoshua, Jehovah saves." Jehovah saves is Yehoshua, from which we get Yeshua, Jesus, the word for salvation, from which we also get Joshua, Josiah, Joash, all the other names from that root, which is Yeshua. So, Josh, where it comes from, along with Jesus.
How about that? I love it. I love it. Thank you. Well, once again, Pat, this was an honor. I really appreciate you taking the time. I don't think I'll keep you any longer. Thank you so much. I will make sure once this is published, I'll get everything out to you, okay?
Great. I look forward to it, man.
Thank you, Pat. Take care, sir.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.